Optimistic and pessimistic people are both realistic. The difference is how they view the future. So pessimistic people will look at a set of facts and say, we're doomed. Optimistic people will look at the set of facts and say, we got problems, but somehow we will figure it out. They don't necessarily have the answer, but they believe there's an answer out there. When you look at great leadership and the ability to move people and change the mood, it's about creating that optimism.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Ben Morton Leadership Podcast. It's the weekly show that brings you inspiring interviews with senior leaders and genuine subject matter experts from all around the world. And it's all designed to help you become the very best leader you can possibly be. Whether you are just starting out in leadership or you're on your fifth CEO role, there will be tips, insights and tactics from my guests and myself that will help you be an even better leader. And the best part, it's completely free. Today, we have the privilege of hosting Stephen Gaffney, a renowned expert in creating high-achieving teams. Stephen brings a wealth of cross-discipline ideas and best practices to his clients, which include Fortune 500 companies, associations, and government agencies. And today, he's bringing some of those ideas and best practices to us. As an author, speaker, and trusted advisor, Stephen has earned a reputation for delivering fresh, innovative, and consistently successful approaches to organizational excellence and development. So, in this episode specifically, you will learn the importance of maintaining a positive mood as a leader, and Stephen's view about how increasing the pace of work can lead to enhanced outcomes, better outcomes, and organizational success. We'll also examine his three questions for significantly enhancing team cohesion, improving communication, and overall team effectiveness. And alongside that, we'll look at some practical strategies for building trust, increasing your leadership credibility, as well as your influence. And as always, there's lots more in this episode as the conversation goes where it naturally did. That is enough of an introduction, though. So get ready for a deep dive into building, creating, leading high-achieving teams, honest communication, and change leadership. Here's my interview with Stephen Gaffney. Stephen, can I start off by asking you to tell us about your first memorable leadership experience in the workplace, good or bad? And how that went on to shape you as an individual and your own approach to leadership?
Great question. One of the stories I'd like to share is when I was getting rolling in this business, right? And I was a year into speaking around honest communication. And at that point, it was really very general. But here's the issue. I actually thought I had it already figured out. And so I've been doing a bunch of sessions. So I did this one session that I was so bad that people walked out. They didn't wait for me to turn my back. They just left. And by the end of the two-hour session, it was a two-hour session at that time, about half the people had already left. The other half, I think, just felt sorry for me. But here's the interesting point is that I really was down on myself afterwards. And then after a few days of feeling sorry for myself, I started to dissect what actually happened. And I realized all of those things I could correct. And it was, I didn't know how to manage group dynamics at the time. And so I started to study it. And then I became very proficient at managing dynamics. And after that, the next session I did was light years ahead of where I would have been. So what's the point? The point is, a lot of our achievements in life are based on our failures. But the key is, are we growing from our failures? So that taught me very early on, not that I want to fail, but if there's ever a mistake, is to make sure I learn from mistakes, which sounds very obvious, but so many people repeat the same mistakes over and over again. And the reason why I found this out is because they tend to blame other people. So I'll just share with you one other interesting point that I work with a lot of CEOs, admirals, and generals, and, you know, just top leaders. And I've been fortunate enough to do this. And I have found that one of the defining traits of great leadership is they blame themselves first. Bad leaders blame others first. And the reason why to blame or take responsibility, however you want to word it, is because it puts you in the driver's seat of doing something. So anyway, that was one of the many, and I had other failures I could tell you about, but, you know, big mistakes and things where you really grow from them.
Yeah, it reminds me, you being from the US, you might be able to help me out here. I don't know if it is a famous quote from John Wooden or maybe Bear Bryant. I think it's John Wooden where he goes, if something went well, they did it. If something went semi-good, we did it. If something went badly, I did it. That's all it takes to get people to win games. Was it a John Wooden quote? Do you know?
I'm not familiar with that, but John Wooden's fantastic coach because I think he won 9 college basketball championships in 11 years. And what's really astonishing about that is when you think about any college, right, they're changing out players. So he was not successful based on a player. He was successful on his mindset and the way he coached. And one of the things about John Wooden is he would ask people, did you give it your best? Not so much what the score was, but when you get off the court, did you give it your best? And it's something we need to ask ourselves, do we give it our best? And I think sometimes inside we know when there's something that didn't go well, we didn't really give it our best. Maybe we thought we had it, you know, maybe we got overconfident, or maybe we just weren't paying attention or something, but it's really, did we give it our best?
Stephen, I want to take you back, actually, if I may, as well, to what you just shared a few minutes ago about your experience of working with these senior CEOs, admirals and generals, and about how they really take responsibility when sort of things don't go according to plan. And I wonder, based on that, what advice you could give to people listening, because I think there's often a tension that exists, right, in that when we are starting out in our career and wishing to climb the corporate ladder, to use that analogy, we can have this tendency to think, well, if I demonstrate that it's my failing, then that's going to reflect badly on me. So there can be a tendency to, let's say, not be quite so good at putting a hand up and saying, I've failed, because we think that might reflect badly on us. And to take that leap of faith and sort of trust and believe that being very authentic, having a lot of integrity and going, do you know what? That's my mistake. And now I'm going to act to fix it. Can feel hard and scary, right? So for anybody who's wrestling with that dilemma, what would you say to them based on your experience?
Well, when we blame ourselves or we take responsibility, it puts us in the driver's seat. The new book that I've written is called Unconditional Power. And it's on the idea that when we're in a good mood, we're smarter. You ever notice that? When we're in a good mood, we're smarter. And it's not only about our mood, but it's about others, right? And so I've identified 3 moods, and it's not going to sound like I'm going to answer your question, but I am. It's just kind of given a context of this. But one mood is a powerless mood. And that's where we feel like, what difference can I make? I'm only one person here. The second type of mood is where I have found most people wind up, but they think they're powerful, but they're what I call conditionally powerful. Conditionally powerful is where we say, I can get that done as long as there's more resources, as long as there's more money, as long as that person does this or whatever. Even the way people talk about their happiness, you know, I'd be happy if that person would do this. And a mentor of mine said to me years ago, happiness is an inside job. Happiness is an inside job. So taking responsibility. So second type of mood is conditionally powerful, where we're kind of, it's conditions on other things. But the desirable mood is unconditionally powerful. And unconditionally powerful is where we recognize there are legitimate conditions, but we spend 100% of our energy on what we are going to do about it. And when we do that, organizations and our lives can shift dramatically. So to your point, the challenge is that when we blame others or we're hesitant to put our hand up and say, it's on me, what we're really saying is I'm going to blame or set up conditions, which gives myself excuses. But if I take 100% responsibility for my life, I'm not always the cause of the stimulus, what happens, but I'm 100% responsible for how I respond. You know, as a cancer survivor, I'm completely fine now, but I went through cancer and, you know, I'm not responsible, you know, cancer, who knows what the cause of it is, but I'm 100% responsible on how I was going to respond to the cancer, what I was going to do with my business and whatnot, which we can talk about. But the point is that when we're in the driver's seat of our life, it gives us much more control. So if you think about it this way, there might be a traffic jam or potholes, but if you're driving your car, you're the driver, you can drive around it. It's not that those aren't potholes or obstacles or traffic jams, but what are we going to do about it? So a lot of what people do in the workplace and in their lives is they think they're powerful, but they're really conditionally powerful, which is about giving up our control.
That reminds me of, it's probably one of the most impactful books I've ever read, which was Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, who survived the concentration camps. And he said in there, I realized one thing the guards could never take away from me was my right to choose how I respond to whatever they did. And I wonder if you're happy to share how much of the perspective you just shared around the different types of power, how much of that came about as a result of your experience with cancer, Stephen?
Some of it, actually. And so understanding that distinction, which I did develop later after the cancer, but reflecting on how I dealt with the cancer, it was that distinction, which actually led me down the road to discovering this distinction about conditionally powerful and whatnot. What I would say is my perspective generally has been hard on myself, because when we're hard on ourselves, we can change things, right? And so I've always had that kind of perspective, but it did help me deal with cancer. And what was really interesting about the cancer experience is that happened in 2009, which is in the middle of the Great Recession. People remember, because it hit the world, right? And people were astonished. And you know, one of the first things to go in business is consulting, you know, training, that type of thing, which is what I do. So faced with cancer and faced with that recession, it still was, what am I going to do about this? So I took that opportunity to retool my business and actually move forward. So when you really look at life, there is so much we cannot control, but we're 100% responsible for how we respond. And I watch this in meetings too. I'll get dropped in to work with really high performing, high achieving teams. And I'll see that even sometimes it's easy to slip into things that are not in our control. Like, what's the market going to do? Or what's this? And when you really look at it, what's within our control? What are we going to do about it? So I see meetings where even wasting time talking about things that are not in our control, instead of spending 100% on how we're going to respond to it. So people might be listening, they might be really down in their life sometimes, or maybe they're going through a divorce, or maybe they're, you know, something happened at work and, you know, somebody's really a jerk to deal with. And I'm not doubting that. Those aren't very difficult times or difficult situations. But don't waste an ounce of your energy on anything you cannot control. Focus what you're going to do about it. And here's the other thing. People sometimes say, well, there's not much I can do about it. That's ridiculous. We live in a world now where Google, ChatGPT, and all the other sources take your toughest problem and Google it, or, you know, ChatGPT, whatever it is. And there's solutions out there, whether it's from me, from other experts, whatever. It's at our fingertips about solutions, but we have to believe that there's our solutions out there. But one of the ways to believe it is to say, what am I going to do about this?
So linked to all of that, are there any particular approaches you use or share with people to help them, I guess, understand where they might be able to have some control or influence? Because listening to you talk, it strikes me that part of what you're exploring here with these three moods is sort of almost knowing how to pick and choose your battles, right? Because there will be some things that it might be causing me to be down, or I might be exerting a lot of mental bandwidth thinking about it. But actually, if there is very, very little, even nothing I can do about that, the best thing, as Covey would say, right, is to let it go and focus where you can have control. Like, but one of the challenges is knowing how to make that distinction, right? So how does one go about that?
Well, first of all, we have to look at things in a critical way. Like, one of the examples is where people will say, you know, you can't change people. But where would we be today if the greatest leaders of our time, like Gandhi and Martin Luther King and many, many great leaders, said you can't change people? You can change people, but by changing yourself, that actually is a trigger that can cause other people to change how we respond, how we look at things. So I'll give you some examples. But where I want people to be is, we develop these excuses. Well, people don't change. And That's just not true. Are you or me the same person we were 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago? Hopefully, we weren't bad 5 or 10 years ago, but hopefully we're all growing and changing. So people can change if they really want to. So what can we do with in our control? Well, in the book Unconditional Power, there's many strategies, but here's one as an example. We can talk as many as we have time for. But one of them is intentional disruption. Intentional disruption is where something is going in the wrong direction and you almost feel like a victim or like powerless, but you redirect it. An example is, you ever have somebody in your life who complains a lot and you're like, oh gosh, every time it's always something negative. Well, just start asking the question, well, what would you suggest? What would you suggest? That actually is an intentional disruption because whoever asks the questions controls the conversation. So if you ask a different question, I have found it sends the whole conversation in a totally different direction. So there are three great questions you can ask. What would you suggest? What would it take for you to agree? Right? Somebody says, well, I disagree. Good question is, what would it take for you to agree? You propose something to your boss or customer and they say no. Well, what would it take for you to change your mind? What would it take for you to be open to what I'm saying? What would it take for you to reconsider the situation? Or you're in a meeting and you're just in the meeting. You're not the leader and people are going at it. And it's like, I disagree. You just might say, well, what's it take? What would it take to get some agreement here? What would it take to move it forward? And a third great question, which will disrupt a lot of conversations, will be, can you live with it? Can you live with it? You know, people get so hunkered down on little, minute, stupid things. We all do, myself included. But it takes sometimes somebody to say, well, is this a deal breaker or can you live with it? And when you ask, can you live with it, it actually forces that person to reflect, is this really important? Incidentally, if somebody says, I can't live with it, you go back to question number one. Well, what would you suggest then? What would it take for a degree and can you live with it? I have never seen to date someone who's used those three questions who has not had a breakthrough in a conversation.
I'm so pleased you shared those because when I was doing my research for our conversation today, I saw those. I think it might have been on your LinkedIn profile and in other interviews you were giving. And I think they're so, so useful. And what struck me about them is it's a great way to help make a group sort of take shared responsibility and accountability, right? Rather than it just being about one person, because you're constantly flipping it around and getting them to be active rather than just in victim complaining mode, right?
Absolutely. In fact, I have found that another trait of great leaders is they ask more questions than most people. In other words, they spend more time listening than they do transmitting. Conventional wisdom often is great leaders are always giving their speeches and in the transmit mode. But what I have found is great leaders spend more time listening than they do transmitting because we learn things and we're able to adjust things. But also, you can redirect an entire conversation, an entire mood of a team or group by just using intentional disruption. Let me give you an example. I was working with this organization and this particular team. They were really complaining about the leadership. I didn't have the leadership in the room. I had kind of mid-level folks. And so they were complaining, you know, we would do great if, you know, that conditional power. And I said this question, given that you are the only person you can control, what would you suggest we do? And they went back to complaining. It took about 2 to 3 times for me to say, given that you are the only person you can control, what would you suggest? How do we move forward? What do we do here? After me asking that several times, somebody said, you know, we could probably stop complaining and offering solutions. And somebody said, you know, we could probably, you know, be a little bit clearer in our communication. You know, and they went down this path. And once somebody started to say a solution, it triggered other people. And the whole team, the whole group redirected and their energy was focused on solutions. So what's the answer? The answer is to ask better questions. You know, I could have said, well, remember, you know, you got to focus on yourself. That would be a statement. But remember, whoever asks the questions controls the conversation. So when we ask a question, it causes people to think. I mean, you can even impact people's mood in a favorable or down mood. One way you could say, well, what's the worst thing that's happened over the past week? Or I could say, what's the best thing that's happened over the week? You can literally help transform people's mood. So intentional disruption is an excellent strategy to redirect an entire team, but it's based on us thinking about asking questions rather than getting in the transmit mode.
And I find that fascinating as well. Something to share, and then I'll get your expertise on this, Stephen. So I do very little of it now because I've shifted the focus of my work. But over the years, I spent a great deal of time, probably similar to you, I think, doing a lot of team development work with a lot of senior teams. And in the early days of doing that, one of the things I would do, which is probably what every team development facilitator does, is we'd spend some time working on a team charter or a team set of ground rules around how we're going to interact with each other. And after a while, I stopped including that in my sessions because I just started to realize, and I'd done this with teams I led when I was in the corporate world, they have, excuse my language, bugger all impact most of the time because we spend a lot of time working on it and wordsmithing it and debating like the nuance of the language, when actually back then a good thing to say would have been like, okay, I know you would prefer it said this, but can you live with it if it says this? That would have helped back then, but I didn't have that insight. And then I found even if we got to the point where there was a list of 10 behaviors that everyone agreed to, it would kind of go in the drawer and get forgotten about, or people would sort of have the mindset, well, I'm not going to do that because I'm not sure Stephen is. So if he's not going to do it, what's the point in me doing it? So everyone ended up looking at everybody else to make the change, and then nobody did. And then latterly, just in probably the last 2 years before I stopped doing team development work and focused back on pure leadership, I started to say, well, I've had two things. Let's write a team charter, but write it in the first person. So I will, rather than we will, because that's a little bit more accountability. Or I scrapped it all together and said, okay, as a result of today's session, what is one thing that you're going to do, Stephen, to make this team more effective? What's one thing you're going to do, Suzanne, to make this team more effective? And I don't care if they're 10 different things, as long as everyone is going to do something themselves that's going to benefit this group, which speaks to your point, I think, around taking control and understanding where the real power lies, right?
Yeah, it's an excellent point. A lot to unpack out of what you said, because so much value. So even on the latter point of asking, you know, what are you going to do about this? I work a lot with leadership teams. So that's really where we spend a lot of, I spend a lot of time and making them high achieving. And so we'll teach a concept, or I'll teach a concept, and then we'll do a go round. And it'll be, what are you specifically going to do differently to help out the team? And I'll mention that several times. And I'll say, I'm not interested in, well, I hope this other person really changes, because we have no control over that. And people usually laugh because that's what they're thinking. Like, you know, I teach a point and they're like, oh, I really hope that other person's listening. And hopefully they are making a move. But still, what are we going to do about it? How are we going to achieve? And what are we going to, how are we going to be able to move forward? And then on the whole team charter thing, so I've identified 12 essential elements of a consistently high achieving team. And they're a set of tools. But whatever it is, whether it's my tools, somebody else's tools, the thing is, don't create anything that we're not going to use, but use what we do create. So let me give you a specific example. One of my clients is Amazon, and they have 14, now 16 leadership principles. And no matter what people think about Amazon, and I really love Amazon, I just, not because they're a client of mine, but they're just, it's a fantastic organization. Here's what's different. Not only have they created the leadership principles, but they actually refer to it. So I often say to companies, have you codified your culture? And then do you use it? So to your point, the charter could be great, but if we're not using it, what's the point? So companies that are really making moves, they develop tools, but they refer to it. No use creating a vision that sounds like all the other companies that we're not going to use. Create something that we're going to use and stop wordsmithing, but say essentially what we're going to do and make it sound different and then refer to it. There's a book called Secret of Rockefeller Habits or something like that. I don't know. It's by Vern Harnish. He's a great, great author and does a lot of great work. But I think his quote is, if a leader's not being mocked, they're not repeating enough. If a leader's not being mocked, they're not repeating enough. So what I always say to my clients is, there's certain key points, whether it's a charter, vision, whatever, rules, repeat so much that they go, I know what you're going to say, Ben. And then if I say it accurately, I've got it. And when you look at great teachers and great coaches, they have repeated certain things over and over again. But for some reason, we get afraid of it. So to your point, no use creating a vision or charter or whatever or strategy if we're not going to use it, right? And refer to it constantly.
Yeah, I love that point around sort of being mocked and repetition, right? And I mean, the other piece with that, and this is hard to sort of describe when we've not got the visual on, But often, again, I'll be working with a MD or a CEO, and I might have gone out and been speaking to their team. And often the feedback is people aren't totally clear on the vision and direction. And the response is often, "Oh, Ben, we've been talking about this for months. Like that, why don't they get it? That can't be the case." At which point, it's now at the point where I've almost got this pre-prepared in my notepad, where I'll bring out a little timeline and I kind of mark on it, okay, here's when you started thinking about the new vision. Some time passes, maybe 4 weeks. You bring in your closest advisors and you talk to them. Some more time passes. You bring in your top team. Some more time passes. You bring in the next layer down. Some more time passes. You bring in the whole organization and your big bang launch of the vision, values, whatever it is. Some more time passes and you go, "Why don't they get it? We've been talking about this for months." Well, you have, but the rest of the organization hasn't, right? And by then, as a leader, we're often on to the next thing, the next project, and we forget we've got to land that one because it's new. It's so key, isn't it? It's so key.
Yeah, in fact, I found that clarity is defined by the receiver, not the sender.
Yes.
But often people say, "I was perfectly clear. I've said it several times." And I'm saying, we don't define clarity. The receiver does. So as long as they can repeat it and really get it, then we know we're clear. Incidentally, we don't define good customer service. People say, "Well, I gave great customer service." No, we don't get a chance to define it. They do. "I've been a great leader." No. I don't get a chance to decide that. The people I'm leading decide that, right? And so it's just so interesting about how we'll often, it's easy to slip in the blame mode. And I've worked with leaders who will slip into that. So I love what you're saying. And they don't take into account how it does take adjustment. And sometimes people don't agree with the vision, which means we got to get buy-in. And then sometimes people will use it as an excuse. They do understand it, but they don't really want to abide by it. And that's when I've seen an organization who switched out a lot of leaders and people go, "Yeah, I've seen this happen too. I'll just wait it out. You know, I'll outlast them." But, you know, there's obviously ways to correct it. But I love what you're saying, because we think we're clear, but we don't define clarity. The receiver does.
Yeah, and this all links together really nicely. And back to one of your previous points there, Stephen. I forget what sparked this in me, but it was about 6 years ago where I suddenly had this realization that anytime someone in my team hasn't quite delivered what I needed delivered, I started to say, well, where does the blame sit, or why did that happen? And I've shared this with groups and you can really see a degree of unease when I share it, but it's a fun thought experiment to try and find a reason why we, the communicator, we, the leader, aren't responsible. And I've never really been able to find a way where the finger doesn't point back to me. So if they've misunderstood it, I wasn't clear enough in my communication. I didn't write that email clear enough. If the person couldn't deliver on time because they had other stuff on, well, I didn't fully appreciate what else they was working on. I didn't help them prioritize. If the wrong person has come into my team, then I didn't recruit thoroughly enough. It's really interesting to turn it back on ourselves. And out of that, I got to the point where I've just got a new assistant started, but Amanda, my old assistant, whenever she would do something for me and it wasn't what I needed, I'd make a point. The very first thing, I'd apologize. I'd say, "Sorry, Amanda, I've wasted some of your time here. I wasn't clear." And I said, "This is what I need." And I mean, a lot of the time it's because we're working at pace, right? And some of the context that's in our head doesn't make it out of our mouth or onto the document that we're producing. So I guess it's back to understanding, to your point, that kind of power of control rests with us rather than trying to appoint blame everywhere else.
Absolutely. And I love what you're saying because it's factually correct. But here's my argument. Even if it wasn't, which it is,
yeah,
it's still our advantage to take responsibility of the situation. It doesn't work in life to blame anyone for our happiness, our money situation, whatever it is. It's to our advantage to put ourselves in control. So the way I like to view it is, powerless is that mood is when we're in the back seat of our car. Conditionally powerful is we're in the front passenger seat. We're trying to urge the driver.
Yeah, nice.
But unconditionally powerful is when we're driving our own car. And there's so many things. So let's talk about another tool out of the book that people can use and I've been teaching, which is how to reframe the situation, right? So somebody isn't moving, we can say, well, you know, you just got to work harder or whatever. But maybe we can reframe the entire situation. So in the book, I've identified my three favorite reframes. One of them is to reduce the frame. And that is where we look at a situation that's very complicated and we make it simple. And we might say to someone, okay, while this is a major transformation, I do a lot of stuff with change. I might, and I've worked with a lot of leaders on this, is, and they'll say, well, people aren't moving. And so because it's too complicated, what you want to do is say, although the vision is huge, what I need you to focus on within the next month or quarter is just focus on these few things. So if we reduce the frame, it actually has people move forward. Confusion causes delay. Confusion causes delay. And a great example of this is you go to a restaurant, and if the menu is many, many pages, you'll see people like scouring over it or, you know, trying to do this. But it's interesting that some of the best restaurants have limited the choices, right? And so by the limiting the choices, it actually helps us move forward. So for example, do we say to our boss or someone, well, what would you like me to do? Or do we say, give me some ideas of what to do? Or do we say, I've studied the situation and I've identified these three actions. My number one recommendation is this: do I have your approval to move forward? That would be an example of how we've taken a situation that we want our boss to help us with and reduce the frame. Or as a leader, if we want a lot of people to move, how to make something that's complex simple. That's all about reducing the frame. We can talk about other reframes, but the point being is that we can create a different context, a different frame that actually gets people moving. And that's, again, if it isn't working, how do I reframe the situation so people will move forward?
And just to carry on that and to build on your brilliant analogy there, like, how many Michelin-starred restaurants are there in the world with a huge menu? None, right? Because you can't deliver 50 different mains and 30 entrees or starters to a high, high level. You've got to be focused, right? And target all of your resources on a few things to do them brilliantly well. So not only does that breadth create a problem for the restaurant guests, but it makes it difficult for the kitchen, right? And that's true of many organizations, isn't it? They just try and take on too many projects at once, and we end up doing little or nothing with excellence.
Absolutely. It's about, all about reducing the frame. And it reminds me of another story. I used to have a television show out of Fairfax County. It was on public access. It was not very good at all, but it was a show on interviewing people on how they became successful. And this one guy interviewed was really successful in politics at a very early age. And I could share more, but bottom line is I asked him his keys to success. And this is what he would do. He said, whenever I got a new job, I would take all the information, all the responsibilities and goals I could kind of glean from what I was supposed to do. I would craft my top five priorities. I would write them down, rank them. And then I would go to my boss and I'd say, this is how I'm seeing my job. Do you agree? Because I'd like to move forward. It's interesting. It takes a lot less energy to edit than it does to create. And so often people say, well, tell me what to do, versus if we make it simple and clear, then it takes a lot less energy. They can edit. So that's what the various bosses would do. They would edit and say, well, make number three, number one, and alter this or whatever. And then he started moving out. His peers, he would say, in their own jobs would be waiting for direction. And I see this a lot where people would say, well, they haven't made it clear for us what to do. And I'm like, is it really not that clear? And if it isn't that clear, write it up, go to your boss and say, look, until I heard differently, I'm going to move forward on this. Do I have your approval on this? Reduce the frame. So there's all kinds of ways we can apply this, but the key is to take responsibility. It comes back to being in the driver's seat of our life.
And Stephen, what are, I know you've been talking about the book now and doing various podcasts and interviews on it. What is perhaps the one tool in the book that you're really passionate about, but no other podcast interviewer has asked you about, or you've not had the opportunity to talk about?
That's a great question. There's a lot of strategies that are in the book, but one thing that I haven't talked about on a lot of podcasts is about optimism and how valuable that is in creating a different mood, that our optimism can actually be so different. And the distinction I draw in this book is being optimistic versus pessimistic, versus positive and negative. So I used to talk about people being positive versus negative. But the problem is negative people would say, well, I'm being realistic. That positive person is only seeing this frame and seeing this. And I thought, you know what? They make a really good point. So then I started doing some research, and optimism and pessimism is different. Optimistic and pessimistic people are both realistic. The difference is how they view the future. So pessimistic people will look at a set of facts and say, we're doomed. Optimistic people will look at the set of facts and say, we got problems, but somehow we will figure it out. They don't necessarily have the answer, but they believe there's an answer out there. And when you look at great leadership and the ability to move people and change the mood, it's about creating that optimism. I remember I was working with this one CEO, and you know, a lot of the foundation of what we talk about is honest communication and getting the unsaid said. The biggest problem is not what people say, it's what they don't say. And so I was working with this one CEO, and he said, well, I am being, you know, very honest. I'm telling people we have problems. I said, that's fine. What's missing is you're not giving them a hopeful future. And I don't mean just happy talk. I meant being very optimistic, because if you don't believe we're going to come out of this and be much better than we are, then others won't. In fact, I love drawing this distinction between, you know, resilience and perseverance. Most of the stuff out there is about resiliency, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I don't like that word as much as perseverance. And to me, the difference is resilience means being resilient for what's happening, right? Dealing with things. But perseverance to me means not only are we resilient, but we are going to be better than we ever have been before. And that's what I think excites people. So the whole idea of optimism. And then also in the book, we put that over being an observer or a generator. And the idea that some people are optimistic, but they're like an observer, they sit back. But great leaders are not only optimistic, but they're generators. They walk in a situation and say, we got a problem, but we will figure out the answer. So that's one thing I haven't really talked about with podcasts and I'm very passionate about, because optimistic and being a generator in optimism, which we talk a lot in the book, give examples, but it's so critical to our success and the success of others.
That is so interesting, Stephen, because what you've just described there and actually putting it all under the label of optimism, and I've not made this distinction before, but it pulls together the top four findings from the research that's been going on for, I think it's 35 years now, by Jim Kouzes and Barry Posner, who wrote the Leadership Challenge. I'm sure you're familiar with it. And in every round of that research, in every country, the top four things have always been the same. Number one thing has always been number one. Two, three, and four have varied. So it is so solid in terms of a piece of research. But those top four things are honesty, being inspiring, being competent as a leader, and being forward-facing, which is everything you've just described, right? We've got a problem, but this is the future. We can and will fix it. And trust me, because I've demonstrated I've got the ability to bring a vision, a reality, turn this forward-facing vision and actually get us there. Like, all of that is what you've just described under your heading of optimism. And if, Frank, if we give those that follow us that as a leader, chances are they're pretty much going to do anything we ask of them, right? Because A, why wouldn't they? And B, we know that's what people want in a leader they're going to admire and be prepared to follow.
Yeah, and I think what's critical then, once we get that optimistic vision and we're being optimistic, is to match it with actions, right? It's not just talk, although that's critical as a first step to at least paint that picture. But then it's about, here's the actions we're going to take. And then also then it's managing expectations. Listen, folks, some of these actions may fail, but in the end, we will be successful. Another guy I interviewed on my television show, Back to the Bad TV show, was a guy, his name is Scott DiGiammarino. He's a really great leader. And he turned a division that was ranked 121 and he made them number one in a year. And he kept them number one. In fact, I worked with his team. What was really interesting is when he took over the group, he said to the team, we are going to be number one. I hope you're here. But no matter what, we're going to be number one. I want you to be here, but we will be number one. So all the high achievers loved it. And guess what? The low achievers bailed. And that was fine. But what he did was, because high achievers usually attract other high achievers and they want to be around high achievers. So the thing is, it's not so much a heavy-handed message. It's about people want to be going places. I always say there's some critical traits that I found to retaining great employees. The first one is meaningful work. People want to be around meaningful work. In fact, there's three great important traits, meaningful work. And that's like, it's not just that my work is meaningful. I need to get that it's meaningful. Second, we want to be around great relationships with other people that kind of match our mood and have our perspective. And, you know, that a feeling of like a family, that somebody has our back. And the third is about achievements. We want to actually be going places. So when we create that optimistic vision, it's then, all right, now here's some actions we're going to take, and they may not all work, but we will figure out the answer. And then that really inspires people because people are taking action. This may sound obvious, but have you ever participated in a team or watched a team that does a lot of talking, but they don't take action? And speed motivates. It's like I always say to people, do something because that'll excite people. Actions really motivate people.
I've been in some of those teams. I've worked with some of those teams, and some of those teams have even said, like, Ben, I'm sure you've realized already, we like to debate a lot. I'm like, and to your point, so what are you going to do about it? Like, if you know that, you are all senior leaders in an organization. You are the senior leaders. You cannot have that insight and just tell me and shrug your shoulders. Like, what are you going to do about it?
Absolutely.
You've got to act on that. People are looking at you. If you know that about yourself, then so what? But sometimes teams get stuck, don't they?
They do. So two things I like to say about speed that often people don't think about. First one I just mentioned, but I want to explain a little bit more. Speed motivates. High achievers want to be around fast moving things. I mean, this sounds kind of obvious, but again, if we're moving too slow, and I don't mean to be rash, but I mean, defining, for example, what's good enough to move out the door. Not everything needs to be perfect. In fact, most things don't need to be perfect.
I work
in the nuclear world. I work in the with scientists, engineers, and technical folks. That's that profession is around trying to get things as perfect as possible, which makes sense. But not everything needs to be perfect, right? And so speed motivates. But the other thing that really astonishes people is when they, until they really think about it, is speed improves quality. Speed improves quality. Most of us think if I slow down, I'm going to improve quality. You can make an argument for that, but I could also make an argument, and I would propose that when you really think about it, for the most part, speed improves quality. Because if I'm running a company and I work on something that's good enough and I get it out the door, customers will give me feedback. It worked, it didn't work, whatever, and I'm already starting to modify it. But another company that is meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting after meeting to try to get the perfect solution, they don't get it out the door. And inevitably, as soon as they get it out the door, no matter how many meetings they've had, they learn something. You know, we learn more by doing than just by talking. And so I work a lot with the military. That's another thing. And I worked with a lot of different militaries. But anyway, one of the things my favorite quote is, no plan survives first contact with the enemy. It doesn't mean we don't plan, but we have to plan for mishaps. We have to plan for things not being correct, that we got to make adjustments. So people spend way too much time planning instead of getting something out the door, or at least a test case, getting feedback, making adjustments, and move out.
Yeah. That was lesson 101 when I started at the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst. It was no plan survives contact with the enemy. And again, I forget who said it, but the follow-up to that was always, an average plan well executed today is better than a perfect plan executed in a week's time. To your point, right? It's about getting on and acting.
It's interesting because even ideas, right? So people think great ideas produce great results. No, great ideas, but really well executed, produce great results. And in fact, a mediocre idea, well executed, produces great results. And, you know, Steve Jobs talked about that. I was watching some video about him, it was a fascinating interview. He said, you know, people think as soon as you get the idea out, well, that's the hard work. No. The hard work is getting it executed and out the door. And that's really important because so many people are hung up on ideas. Have you ever met consultants or people that always have really great ideas? Well, that's great, but what's getting executed? Because as soon as we get it out the door, we're going to learn things. There's so many things that I thought, oh, this is brilliant. But I start teaching it and I'm like, oh, somebody gives me feedback. And so much of what we've created has been, you know, I've come up with an idea, but I've taught it so many times and adjusted it where now it ends up being producing great results. A good example of this is I developed a strategy called the 2:18 strategy, a strategy that takes only 2 hours and 18 minutes. It's a timed approach, but basically you put in an issue, an outcomes, an actionable plan that's good enough to move out on. Anyway, it took many, many years to get it perfected because in the early stages, it was a different time limit. But But what I got feedback, and then now it works all the time. And so why am I saying that? It's not about the 218. People have various methods. But the thing is, get out there and move on stuff. Take action. So you have an idea, move out on it. Put it to action. Get it tested. Move out rather than just sit there and talk about it.
Yeah, yeah. Before we perhaps move on to final questions, Steve, I just want to go back and highlight something you said a while ago, which is really important to me. And I talk about it a lot in terms of delegation, communication. You touched on being clear about what good looks like. I mean, that often gets forgotten. I mean, when we are asking someone to work on a project, delegating a task, I mean, there's a couple of things that are needed, but in terms of what it is we're asking people to do, I think being clear about what good looks like is really key, or what good enough looks like, because that can be the difference between hours worth of effort, right? If you're asking someone to do some data analysis, let's say, and you just want a rough initial cut to give you that ballpark figure, ballpark idea, to give even an idea if it's worth moving forward on this, then let them know. Because if you've got someone in your team who is a real perfectionist, the difference between 70% accurate and 100% accurate could be hours, days even. And then not only have they wasted time, they'd be massively deflated when they present some meticulous work and you might be a little dismissive of it because I didn't need all of that. So I think what does good look like, or what does good enough look like? What is good enough is so powerful, right? In terms of speed, motivation, quality. It's really important, I think.
Yeah, in fact, I've found that slogans don't make people move, but slogans with actions or slogans with strategies make people move. So this is a good example, right? We've often heard about good enough and moving out when good enough. In fact, one of the essential elements of a consistently high achieving team, which I've found out, is about moving out when good enough is good enough. Now, that's a nice phrase, but what does it actually mean? Well, here's some of the key elements to implementing that, which is really defining what is good enough, right? And is good enough. And, you know, sometimes you say, well, I don't want to have mediocre work. And I'm saying, well, that's not necessarily what good enough is. It's we have to define the threshold, because if we don't, here's what I have found out. High achievers want to produce great results. And so they can get it about good enough, but let's face it, we're all programmed, myself included, to want to perfect things. So we have to develop mechanisms in defining what is good enough to get something out the door. Maybe it is just a time limit. No matter what, within 30 days, we're moving out on it. Maybe it is when it hits this category or this type or this level, we're going to move forward. But we have to define it. But if we just say move out when good enough is good enough, that doesn't move anything. It's that max with actions. And what I have also found out is we've got to define this. What does good enough mean? But also we want to do that at the very beginning, because if we do it as it's going along, then people say, Ben, just give me two more weeks, and I'm going to make it so much better. And I'm not saying this to slow things up. I'm saying it because I take pride in my work. So a lot of high achievers have problems with this. And so the answer isn't to just say lower your standards, but let's define what is good enough. And let's do it at the beginning of the project, not in the middle of the project.
This is really interesting. It's got me thinking about, I guess this is a bit of a parallel, in that when you're talking about slogans there, Stephen, we could find a slogan to support one viewpoint, and we could equally find a slogan that supports the other viewpoint, right? The reason I thought of this, as you was talking about move out when it's good enough and good enough is good enough. My first job after the military, we got this guy to come in and speak at one of our company conferences. He was a management team development consultant, a British guy called Humphrey Waters. In the run-up to England winning the Rugby World Cup in 2003, he famously did a lot of work with the England rugby team. And one of his slogans was, good enough isn't. So he went the other way. Good enough isn't good enough. Like, that's not what we're about. We're about striving for perfection. But I think probably the useful thing here is, like, for leaders, our job as leaders is to apply that intellect, right? To understand, well, where's the real value in this slogan? What slogan or catchphrase or mindset fits with our organization, our culture, our strategy, rather than almost mindlessly grabbing at stuff because it's a headline and it sounds cool. We need to pause and apply that intellect, which then comes back to something we spoke about earlier in this episode as well, which is that questioning. just slowing down slightly to ask some questioning, because it can be very easy, again, when people come to us wanting decisions just to give them an answer. Well, actually, if we can slow down and ask a question, we get to a different outcome. Like I had it just this morning, sitting with Susie on my team. We're talking about a press release for something quite cool that's going on. And she drafted this, was about to send it out. And I read it and I was on the verge saying, yeah, great, go with it. And I looked at it again and went, so what? Like there's no, for the PR person who's receiving it, we weren't really telling them what we expected them to do with it. And she's like, oh yeah. And then she suggested a few things about what we could change. And I went, well, no, hang on. I said, why are we doing this? So it's that instead of just grabbing a slogan, just giving that quick decision, I mean, we need to slow down, right, as leaders, and apply the intellect, apply the thought and rigor at the appropriate time.
Yes.
Rather than just kind of running.
Let's talk about that for a second, because I think you bring up really important points, you know, slogans and how people think and, you know, about one versus another. So this is what I always say is nothing in an extreme is great, right? You know, good enough isn't always the right move. So we all kind of have a tendency. Maybe we are too slow and we need to speed up. Maybe we need to alter that. And I'm not trying to come off my earlier point. Here's what I would say around that rugby coach. I imagine if we interviewed him, I would say, so everything needs to be perfect or excellent. And probably what I imagine he'd say, our goals, we are going to win the championship. So I'm not going to accept anything second best. I'm making this up. I have no idea. But he probably drew a distinction of what is good enough, you know, or let's focus on these things and getting them excellent. So why I'm saying this is it's not about everything, and nor is everything always a good thing in any extreme. It's about balance and somewhat. And so I have found, though, most organizations move too slow rather than too fast. In fact, I had a client of mine say, I've never fired anybody because they move too quick. And so his point was speed is everything. Now, I'm sure we could be rash and get something out the door and then it doesn't work. So, you know, we have to have a balance. It's just like persistence is really great, but we often have to know when to back off. Yes, we need to take action, but we need to kind of take time to reflect, right? We need to help out others, but we also need to rejuvenate ourselves. So everything is somewhat of a balance, but we all kind of have our internal compass and we know where we need to push it. I'll give you an easy example of this that I see it's a micro example, but it just shows how sometimes our internal compass needs to be altered or through feedback. So have you ever led an audience and somebody's asked a question and they're very soft spoken and you say, I'm sorry, could you speak up? When they speak up, they don't really speak much louder because internally that little increase seems like they're yelling, but to everybody else, it's barely measurable. So when I'm coaching people, I've learned that there's a lot of gray area and you're trying to encourage someone. So there's some clients I've said, look, you got to learn to back off a little bit with your team. And others I've said, look, there's no chance in the world you're ever going to come across as a dictator. You're just not like that. So you want to be more decisive, not less decisive. So I love what you're saying because there is a dance. And that's where somebody like yourself and myself comes into play because we can help people kind of figure out where they need to go. But there are certain tendencies and speed motivates and speed generally improves quality. But things rash don't work. But there are those tendencies. And good enough can really often be good enough as long as we define it.
That's a lovely place to finish up, Stephen, other than the one final question I'll ask you in a second. But yeah, so much of leadership is a balance, right? It's about balancing competing needs, balancing different approaches. It's all a balance, which is why I often say I think leadership is a lot more an art than a science. It's shades of gray rather than black or white. But Stephen, one final question, which is the standard question I ask every guest now as we wrap up. What would you say is the best mistake that you've ever made? Or to put it another way, something that seemed like a disaster initially, but turned out to be very fortuitous?
Oh, God, I've made many mistakes. Well, I'll give you an example that comes to mind. So one of my first television interviews I ever did, I got back to the office and I said to my assistant, so how'd I do? And I thought I did excellent. Ben, I'm telling you, I thought it was stellar. And I'll never forget, Christina looks at me and she goes, do you really want me to tell you? Mm-hmm. Which is never a good opening line. That usually means something bad's about to say. I said, yes, I did. So I of course, I wanted the feedback. And she said, you know, I repeated too much. It was an awful interview. And so I was so embarrassed because it was on television, was national television. And I was like, oh my gosh. And again, I was like, got to hang up this career of ever doing any media stuff. And then after I felt sorry for myself for a while, I realized I just have to learn how to do interviews a lot better. And what I realized was, for example, in that case, is to know my main point. What am I trying to accomplish? How am I trying to help people? And maybe have a few talking points. I can talk about a lot of things, but especially when you only have a 5-minute interview on television, what's the main point? I had never really thought about that. So after I was done feeling sorry for myself and I analyzed the situation, I realized all those things, again, I could correct. And then again, I was light years ahead when I was doing my next interview. So again, it goes back to the very first thing we talked about. Really, our biggest failures end up driving our biggest achievements if we're just persistent enough.
Love it. Stephen, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. It's been a wonderful conversation. I've got a lot from it. I know everybody who is listening will have taken away, well, I say a lot more than one thing that they can straight away go and use. So thank you for sharing your time, your energy, and your wisdom. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. And thank you so much for having me.
Before you head off to your next task or next podcast, let me just say thank you so much for joining Stephen and myself for this episode of the show. I really appreciate the fact that you tune in every week and support the show. There is just one thing you can do to help me and to say thank you for providing this free resource for you. And that is just to leave a quick rating and review for the show, wherever you happen to be listening. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, just scroll down, you'll find the review section, and you can just click on the button there to leave your rating and review. I would really, really appreciate it. And before you go, let me once more just remind you to go and check out the Leaders Kit Bag episodes of the podcast. It's the new weekly micro edition of the podcast. Every episode is just 5 or 6 minutes long, and it focuses on one very practical leadership tip or tactic. So far, we've covered things like planning and prioritization, resilience, motivation, and soon we're going to be looking at the importance of connection as a leader, for team development, and actually for long-term health and well-being. And then once you've listened to the Leaders Kit Bag episodes, then please share them with your colleagues and friends so that together we can improve the leadership capability in our companies, charities, and institutions. After all, I really do believe that the world needs great leaders now more than ever. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, lead on.